me today. Appreciate very much your presence. And we do have several visiting with us. We are honored that you've come to be a part of our service this morning. And I want you to know that it is my intention and my goal to preach the truth. It is your responsibility to compare what I say against the standard of God's Word. You are responsible for the things that you believe in and the way that you live your life. And I want you to know that you can understand the Bible. The Bible is not such a difficult book that we cannot understand it. And if we understand it, then of course we are going to be in harmony and unity with each other. It's hard for me to imagine, but there are actually people who believe that baseball is boring. I see some heads doing that. And I understand why. I understand that it's not as action-packed, perhaps, as a football game or a basketball game or hockey. And I realize that there are many who do not really know or appreciate the intricacies of the game of baseball. But even in baseball, there are moments when there is high excitement, when something big happens, something great, something that will get people to their feet. It's called the walk-off home run. What is a walk-off home run? Well, it's a home run that comes at the end of the game. In the ninth inning or later if the game is tied, it occurs in the bottom part of that inning. And what it means is someone hits the ball over the fence and that scores enough runs so that the game is over with. And you can understand the excitement because at that point, if you need a walk-off home run, then you are either tied or you're behind. And so you can imagine the excitement that takes place when someone is up to bat and they hit the ball over the fence and that's the end of the game. There are many events in a baseball game that are less spectacular, and we understand that. But again, we focus on those things that stand out, the big event, the great event of a game. That's not to say that the walk-off home run is more important than other parts of the game. It may very well be that earlier in the game, someone came to bat, and they just barely got the bat on the ball, and they punched it out in short left field. And so all they did was get a little bloop single. Not as exciting as a ball smashed over the fence. Not as exciting as seeing someone run around the bases. But it scores that run. It scores a run that is necessary to the win quite often. And so if you have a situation where you go into the bottom of the ninth tied, and you have a batter up without anyone on bases, and that batter hits the ball over the fence, that one run will win the game. But the only reason we'll win the game is because someone earlier had the little bloop single, not anything exciting, but yet a runner came around and scored. But again, most of us would rather see the long ball than the little bloop single, and I understand that. We want these great accomplishments. We most often remember these great accomplishments and even great failures, things that stand out. But I want you to realize that little things really can make a big difference, just like that little bloop single. And when you think about life, just imagine all of the little things that take place that make life so enjoyable that quite often will have an impact on who you are, the things that are important to you. And we could go through many, many different pictures, but just imagine the little things of life that really do make a difference. They may not stand out as some of the big things in life do, but they make a difference, don't they? There are some amazing stories in the Bible. Some events that take place that are almost unbelievable, because as far as what we know, what we understand, they really go beyond what is natural. And so these little deeds take place that perhaps leads us up to this amazing event. In the passage read a few moments ago in the book of Exodus, chapter 15, verse 1 through verse 5, we have there the Jews being delivered from Egypt. What a wonderful, spectacular event that was. An event that most of us know something about, and probably a great deal about, because we've studied it time and time again. We hear about it in our young classes. They learn about Moses. They learn about the Egyptians. They learn about the deliverance of God for the people. In Exodus chapter 15, Moses and the children of Israel sing a song to the Lord for what the Lord had done for them. The fact that the Lord had delivered them from this mighty power. Understand that Egypt was the most powerful nation at that time. Pharaoh had the most powerful army. The Jews were slaves. And before this deliverance, they were going through some difficult times, hard times, put on them by the Pharaoh. In the book of Exodus, chapter 1, and verse 14, they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. This is Pharaoh putting greater burdens upon the people of Israel because they were growing. They were multiplying. They were getting strong. And he was trying to do something to slow that down. In verse 22, so Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. And so when all else failed, Pharaoh gave the order to his people that if they saw this baby child, this baby boy, that he was to be thrown in the river. He was to be killed to slow down the growth of the people of Israel. And it was in this setting that eventually the Israelites would be freed. We note in this setting a mother's desperate action. In Exodus chapter 2, in verse 3. We have there the birth of Moses, his family, his mom and dad try to hide him, and for 3 months they do. But he gets to that point where they are afraid that he's going to be found out. And if he is, they know what will happen. When she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, dabbed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. This was a quiet event. Something that did not stand out. It was something relatively small. Now, granted, it took a lot of courage, a lot of desperation for his mom to do that. There's no doubt about that either. But when you think about the big picture, this was a mother simply doing what she felt like she had to do, what she needed to do, what she wanted to do in order to try and save her child. In all probability, other mothers were doing the same kind of thing, trying to figure out some way to save my baby boy. We note a sister's watchful eye in all of this. In verse 4, his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. And so she watched as this little ark of bulrushes was set in and as it floated down the river. She wanted to know what was going to happen. And we understand that. Again, this is not an event that just jumps out at you. And it's certainly one that is understandable. You would think that the family would want to know. We don't know if this was the sister's idea. We don't know if she came up with it or if she was told to do this by her parents. We don't know. But she was there. And she was there to see what was going to take place. In verse 7, then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the maiden went and called the child's mother. You see, after Pharaoh's daughter found the child, she had compassion, it says, on this child. She was moved by this child. And the sister went and asked, "Would you like for me to go and find someone to nurse this child?" And of course, the story is here that she went and she secured the mother, her mother, as well as Moses' mother, to come back and to take care of this child. We note in all of this, Moses' salvation. In verse 9, then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." This is the daughter speaking, the Pharaoh's daughter speaking to the mother of Moses. So the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." Moses was saved. We don't know how many male babies were murdered by Pharaoh, by the Egyptians. This one child was saved. His salvation. And what was done leading up to this point. And the courage of his mother. Not an act that jumps out, but we understand an act of love, an act of concern by a mother of this child. And the sister who goes and she watches and she then speaks to Pharaoh's daughter and she's able to bring Moses' mother to raise him. And when this child grows up a little bit, she's brought to Pharaoh's daughter, and she raises him as her own son. What a wonderful story that is. I want you to realize something. All of that made it possible for God to choose this man to do one of the greatest events in our existence, in man's existence. In the book of Exodus chapter 3, verse 9 and verse 10. After Moses had grown, he was now 80 years old. He had left Egypt. You know the story. He was a shepherd, and God appeared to him there in a burning bush. And God is speaking to him. "Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them." And so, still here 80 years later, the Egyptians are oppressing the people of Israel, making their life miserable, and it's going to get worse. "Come now therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." And so God had chosen this man that he might go and deliver the people of Israel. And in so doing, as we will find in a moment, he destroyed the most powerful army of that day and time by the little things that he did. I also want you to realize that tragic stories in the Bible can begin with little deeds. We read about Egypt's demise in the book of Exodus chapter 14, verse 26 through verse 28. The Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen." You remember the story how God had parted the Red Sea that the Israelites might escape. And that he had parted the Red Sea in such a way where it was dry, the bed was dry, and they were able to simply walk across. Now, the Egyptians are pursuing. And God is causing the water to come back upon them. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. This mighty army, not a single one survived. Every single soldier, including Pharaoh, dead. What a mighty event in the lives of Israel and the Egyptians. You'll notice that Moses was told to stretch out your hand over the sea. A very simple task, a very simple deed. Nothing that stands out. And no doubt we could go and we could stretch out our hand and the sea would not part. We could go and we could stretch out our hand and nothing would happen to the sea. But when Moses did it according to God's command, according to God's will, the things happened exactly as God said that they would. The demise of Egypt. But it didn't just start there. There were other things that led up to it. Other things that led up to the time when Moses stretched forth his hand. If you go back, when Moses went to Egypt and he confronted Pharaoh, in the book of Exodus chapter 5, verse 1 and 2, Pharaoh proudly, arrogantly said, "Who is the Lord?" Listen, afterward Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." The question may have been legitimate. He did not know the Lord. And the truth is, at this point in time, Israel really did not know the Lord. But he was going to find out. Pharaoh was going to learn exactly who the Lord is by various wonders being done, by the plagues that brought upon them. We note Pharaoh's arrogance in all of this. In chapter 7 and verse 4, "Pharaoh will not heed you so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my enemy, my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them." At this point in time, Pharaoh had already seen enough to where he should have known about the Lord. He was still rejecting the Lord in his arrogance. "Pharaoh will not heed you." But there was a reason for that. God was going to truly show him and show the world exactly who he is. He was going to do something so big, so grand, that no one could deny. So Pharaoh's arrogance had something to do with Egypt's demise. His lies. In the book of Exodus chapter 8, in verse 8, "Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, 'Entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord.' He didn't. He lied. He changed his mind. And again, his mind was hardened. We also read in verse 15 in connection with this, that very point. "When Pharaoh saw that there was a relief from the frogs, he hardened his heart and did not heed them as the Lord had said." You see, this event, this tragic event of the Egyptians didn't just happen. There were things that led up to perhaps seemingly small things to people. But they led up to this tragic deed. Tragic stories about God's people can begin with little deeds as well. You see, Israel, being freed by God, being delivered by God through the hand of Moses, they of all people should have known. They of all people should have had absolute faith, conviction, trust in God. They saw His power throughout all of the plagues, including the deliverance of their own firstborn. They witnessed the parting of the sea. Time and again, God was with them. But if you look in the book of Numbers, chapter 14, verse 20 through verse 23, you'll find there that the Lord was going to punish them because of their little deeds. The Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word. You see, God was on the verge of destroying the people and making a nation from Moses. And Moses basically talked him out of it. So he says, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. He's talking about Israel. He says, I'm going to make myself, my glory, known. They're going to understand who I am. They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. And so for 40 years they were made to wander in the wilderness. For 40 years until all of those who came out as adults from Egypt, all of those had died. Only 2 were allowed to enter into the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. You see, that great story, that story that stands out to us, began with little deeds. The complaining out of fear that Israel did. In Exodus chapter 14, verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Again, I can understand their fear. God had just delivered them. Pharaoh had sent them out. Now Pharaoh was coming after them with this mighty army. And they look back and they see this. And they cried out. Then they said to Moses, here's the problem. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to have served the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Now think about this for a moment. I get and understand the fear of this mighty army descending upon them. But remember all that God had already accomplished. All that God had already done to get them out of Egypt. Why in the world would they be so fearful that they would then turn their anger against Moses, God's servant, and in essence against God? Complaining because they were thirsty. Exodus chapter 15, verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the children complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And then again, in Exodus chapter 16, verse 2 and 3, they complained because of hunger. The whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." And you know the story, don't you? Time and time again, they complain against Moses. They complain against God. They just seem not to be very satisfied. And so you fast forward a little bit to a time when they are there near the Promised Land. 12 spies are sent over. They're ready to take it. The 12 come back. And sadly, 10 give a bad report. In Numbers chapter 14 and verse 1. "So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt.'" There they go again. "Or if only we had died in the wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." And again, remember what God had done for them. He had fed them. He had been with them. He had protected them. And now, because 10 come back and they talk about the giants, and they talk about the fortified cities, and the fact that the Israelites were like grasshoppers in their eyes, they brought this fear of disbelief on the people. And the people fell for it. It would have been better for us. Let's choose some new leaders. Let's choose someone to take us back, to return to Egypt. And again, remember, the Egyptian army had just been destroyed. They complained out of unbelief, disbelief. A bad report had been given. In Numbers 13, verse 27, "Then they told him and said, 'We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there.'" Then verse 31, "The men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.'" You see, two brought back a positive report. "We can do this with God's help." And so this is the response of the others again. "And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies in the land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. No wonder the people were afraid.'" But you see, they forgot the promises of God. There was a counter view in all of this, I mentioned. In verse 30 of Numbers 13, "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it.' But the people would not listen." The people would not listen. And so you have a series of really smaller events, sending out 12 to spy out the land. Disagreement as to what they should do. 10 giving a bad report. 2 giving a good report. You see all of these little things that are taking place day in and day out. A whole lot like our lives sometimes. We go and we do the things of living. We follow the steps. And what we find is that sometimes we make poor choices and we do things we should not do. And even though perhaps those events were relatively small in nature, What can they lead to? What can they result in? Well, we saw earlier that if done right, that they can lead us to good things. But if not, they can lead to our disaster. We're beginning a new year. I don't know what your goals are. I don't know if you're one who sits down and tries to set some goals for the next year or not. You know, most of us remember the big events of our lives, but do we remember the little things that led us up to those events in as much detail? Your wedding day. Maybe an event that you remember something about. But what about all of the little events that led up to that point in time? You watch your child graduate from high school. A great day. But what about all of the little events that led up to that point in time? What I'm suggesting this morning is very simple. Let's take care of the little things. Let's make sure that what we're doing day in and day out, they're the right things of life. And the bigger things of life will take care of themselves. They really will. And you have a better chance of being successful, of being happy, if you do the little things right. We read about two tragic stories. One about the Egyptians. They didn't have to die. But their arrogant, rebellious leader brought that nation down. You look at the people of Israel. What a tragic story. They had every advantage. But again, because of the little deeds of life, they were brought down. I'm going to encourage you right now to think about a little deed. You know, we are all sinners. We've all fallen short of God's glory. But Jesus Christ died that we might have hope. He died that we might be able to avoid, to escape the place of hell. And I'm grateful for that. God's people, Christians, have that advantage. Christians have their sins forgiven. There are a lot of little things that go into it before you become a child of God. You've got to hear the gospel. If you don't know what the gospel is, if you don't know what you need to do to be saved, then I would be more than happy to talk to you about that. But you've got to hear, you've got to believe. You've got to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. You have to turn your heart to Him. You have to confess your faith. You have to be immersed in water for the remission of sins. Those are all relatively small things that we do, but look at where they lead us to. What glory! What a great event! Because when you think about it, the final event is that of salvation. You know, as a child of God, salvation is not guaranteed to us. We have access to the blood of Christ, but if we sin, we can still lose our souls if we don't ask for forgiveness and turn from them. If you've sinned as a child of God, ask His forgiveness. If you need to respond this morning in some way, I would invite you to do so as together we stand and we sing the song that's been selected.